Welcome everybody to the Sittercast for today. And today we're going to have a look at the Majjhima Nikaya number 150, the Nagara Vindeya Sutta, the discourse to those people from Nagara Vinda. Nagara, of course, being the Pali word for a city. Vinda being a word meaning Vinda. This particular discourse has two, according to Sutta Central, has two parallels. One, as always in this chapter of the Majjhima, has parallel in the Chinese Sanyukta Agama, and in addition a Sanskrit fragment from Turfan. And the Sanyukta Agama text, of course, being the Sarvastivadin text, and the fragments, insofar as they've been able to be identified, the Turfan fragments, usually being of Sarvastivada or related school. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was wandering in the Kosalan country with a large sangha of bhikkhus and eventually arrived at a Kosalan village named Nagaravinda. The Brahman householders of Nagaravinda heard the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the Kosalan country with a large sangha of bhikkhus and has come to Nagaravinda. Now a good report of Master Gotama has been spread to this effect, that Master, that Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, and so on and so forth. And of course the stock passage on the praise of the Buddha. He reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Now it is good to see such arahants. And here, of course, as we find many times, the Brahmins are very enthusiastic to go and see the Buddha and so on. And clearly there was issues here, that in some cases the Brahmins would make objections to this and say you shouldn't be going to see the Buddha and these kinds of things. But it's interesting and it's curious that even in those cases where people make the objections to it, they're not even necessarily making objections on religious grounds. Sometimes they say that you shouldn't go see him because he doesn't pay respects to Brahmins or because he's too young, and various kinds of things. So they're more kind of aspects of like social niceties of things rather than the fact that he's necessarily, that his teachings are wrong. I mean, obviously the Brahmins had problems with the Buddha's, certain aspects of the Buddha's teachings as well. But I think it's important to remember or to bear in mind that when we talk about the Brahmins, we can't by any means sort of simply equate them with modern Hindus. Nor can we simply say that Brahmanism was, in a sense, a religion in the same way that we necessarily think about it today. I mean, obviously it was a religion in a certain sense, but Brahmanism in a sense as a religion in fact is almost comparable to Judaism in some ways. That it's not like specifically just a religious or spiritual thing, but it's more like a cultural way of life, and it was about things like, you know, doing the weddings and the sort of ceremonies for the passing of the day and all of these kinds of sort of more sort of culturally embedded practices and traditions and so on and so forth. And so it was in a sense more like a feeling of a people. Rather than like a religion in the sense that we think of a religion as being like a set of kind of beliefs and so on that you can adopt. But for them, well, they're born into it. Yeah, just like with, say, Jewish people, you're born into it. I mean, you can convert, obviously, but there's an idea that it's a people and that this is the culture of our people, which, of course, has a religious and spiritual dimension to it. And I think that because the idea of Brahmanism, in a sense, was a kind of much more broad idea rather than being specifically a religion. I think this is one of the reasons why we see very often that the Brahmins are actually very open to what the Buddha has to say, Obviously, in some cases, they disagree with him, but many cases, they're quite open. They come to see him, and they don't seem to have any particular religious problems, because for them, he's contributing to and expanding their religious or spiritual or ethical understanding in a way that doesn't necessarily threaten their broader culture. Okay, and also another factor to be borne in mind in that is that the within Brahmanism itself was undergoing great changes at that time, and we see a strong development of the Brahmanical ideas through the Upanishads, and a lot of questioning of the ancient truths and these kinds of things. Just one simple example would be in the older Brahmanical ritual text. It says that you have to perform certain rituals every day. And then in one of the later texts from what they call the Brahmanas, from some certain shortly before the Buddha, discusses that and says, well, what happens if you can't do it? Because you have to have all of this equipment and all of this and this time and so on to do the ritual. What happens if you don't get all of those things correct? And it says, well, you can do the ritual by faith. Right? So in other words, you basically do the ritual in your heart, and then that's kind of good enough. Yeah, so we see that kind of movement towards a sort of questioning of the role of ritual and so on and so forth, which you find in Buddhism, is in fact something which you find within the Brahmanical tradition itself. Okay, so the Brahmin householders, and that diversity is expressed, of course, in this stock passage, where they went to see the Buddha. Some paid homage to the Buddha and sat down at one side. Some exchanged greetings with him. And when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, they sat down at one side. Some extended their hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and sat down at one side. Some pronounced their name and clan in the Blessed One's presence and sat down at one side. Some kept silent and sat down at one side. Very important stock passage, yeah? Remember, not everybody who went to the Buddha was the same. Not everyone who's in that culture was the same. Not all the Brahmins were the same. They're all different. They're one big group of Brahmins. They're going to see the Buddha. But even within that group of Brahmins from the same village, right, they all see fit to come and do their thing in their different way. And that's fine. No one's making an issue out of that. And the Buddha accepts them all and will teach and talk to all of them.
Did you mention that list of ways of greeting him? Is it listed from most friendly to least friendly, or is it just different?
It would seem to be from most respectful to least respectful, yeah. It would seem to be the general tendency, yeah? Paying homage and sitting down at one side. So that's what the monastics would do. Some exchanging greetings. G'day, Gotama, how's it going? Right? G'day, Sid, how's it going? Yeah? Some extended their hands in reverential salutation, so they're not, some just pronounce their name and clan, which is a bit kind of formalistic. Like, for example, that's something that, say, a king would do in the presence of someone. So that's like quite a high, you see like King Pasenadi pronouncing that in people's things. So that's like almost like a bit kind of an uppity way of pronouncing itself. And some just kept silent and sat down to one side. You know, they're just kind of checking it out. So householders, if wanderers of other sects ask you thus, householders, what kinds of recluses and Brahmins should not be honoured, respected, venerated and revered, you should answer them thus. Those recluses and Brahmins who are not rid of lust, hatred and delusion regarding forms cognizable by the eye, whose minds are not inwardly peaceful and who conduct themselves now righteously, now unrighteously in body, speech and mind, such recluses and Brahmins should not be honoured, respected, revered and venerated. Why is that? Because we ourselves are not rid of greed, hatred and delusion regarding forms cognizable by the eye, our minds are not inwardly peaceful, and we conduct ourselves now righteously, now unrighteously, in body, speech and mind. It's a bit kind of slightly insulting way of referring to his guests, but anyway. Since we do not see any higher righteous conduct on the part of those good recluses and Brahmins, they should not be honoured, respected, revered and venerated. So in this question that the Buddha raises with these, he immediately raises this question of religious diversity, right? That's the issue at hand, isn't it? Religious diversity. all of these different people supposed to be practicing these different religions, you know, who should we respect? Who should we listen to? A topic that's brought up many times in the suttas. And the Buddha, as always, is not coming from like a dogmatic or a doctrinal point of view. He's not saying listen to the Buddhists and don't listen to non-Buddhists, right? He's saying listen to those who are really restrained, or pay respect to those who are restrained. Who's got rid of greed, hatred and delusion? This is the important thing. Who's able to actually conduct themselves well? Who is actually peaceful at heart? These are the ones worthy of respect.
So you said that you should just direct them anyway, no matter if they're skillful or not, because many Buddhists think that it doesn't matter if the monk is good or bad, you just pay respects anyway and you still get the good karma from it.
Yeah, well, that's that issue that we discussed last week in the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so
I suppose that would have come about with the idea of ordination of lineages and that.
Uh-huh.
Because of course in the sutras you're in some ways defined as people who are on that.
Uh-huh.
Of that kind.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So, so those again who are unrestrained regarding the other senses should also not be revered. Whereas the opposite, of course, is true. If people ask you what kind, if wanderers of other sects ask you, householders, what kinds of recluses and Brahmins should be honoured, respected, revered and venerated? It's a slightly peculiar way of phrasing it, isn't it? Buddha's not saying, you know, to them, what kind of recluses and Brahmins should you respect? He's saying, if wanderers of other sects ask you who should be venerated, why would the wanderers be asking the householders who that the householders should be venerating? I'm not quite sure why they would do that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone know why that would be so?
I think because of the Buddha want to talk something about the culture and custom. Because at the time there are many contemplative people.
Yeah.
Not only the Buddha Gundava. So I think your concern is the Buddha want to get rid of some of the Dao among the Hamanda.
That I understand. What I don't understand is why when the Buddha is talking to the lay people, does he say to them, if the wanderers of other sects ask you, who should we respect? Why does he phrase it in that way? Why doesn't he just tell the householders, who should you respect, and then go on to explain it? Why does he say, why is it that wanderers are asking the householders? That's what I don't understand.
I think a kind of convincing them about who really is acknowledged and contemplated. I think a kind of have more point of
maybe.
Indirectly, isn't it?
Maybe.
He may have more followers when he finds it out like this, but it's not in a direct way.
Maybe it's just making it more indirect, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe the wanderers come around and ask, and if they find out that their kind is respected, then you stick around?
Maybe. Yeah, look, maybe it's just something that's been happening. Maybe somebody mentioned it to him, or someone had asked about this question. So, yeah, it could be. Yeah, Bhikkhu Bodhi doesn't have a note on it. In fact, I don't think Bhikkhu Bodhi has any footnotes on that sutra at all. It's very restrained of him. Might be the only sutra in the Majjhima with no footnotes. Okay. And then the sutta goes on, householders, if wanderers from other sects ask you thus, but what are your reasons and what is your evidence regarding those venerables whereby you say about them? Surely those venerable ones are either rid of lust or practicing for the removal of lust. They're either rid of hate or practicing for the removal of hate. They're either rid of delusion or are practicing for the removal of delusion. Being asked thus, you should answer those wanderers thus. It is because those venerable ones resort to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest. For there are no forms cognizable by the eye there of a kind that they would look at and delight in. There are no sounds cognizable by the ear. There are no odors. There are no flavors. There are no tangibles. They're cognizable by the body there of a kind they could touch and delight in. So there's nothing nice in the forest.
You should read Kasapa's poems then.
Yeah, yeah. I think obviously there's the difference between things that provocative of defilements and things which are not. These are our reasons. This is our evidence whereby we say about those venerable ones, surely these venerable ones are either rid of lust, hatred, and delusion, or practicing for their removal. Being thus asked, householders, you should answer those wonders of other sects in this way. So it's a kind of interesting answer. I mean, it's obviously true to some degree that there's in the forest obviously there's less of the stimulus and all of those kinds of things. But also, I mean, I don't know, it strikes me being a little bit of a simplistic answer, doesn't it? You know, you can obviously, there are plenty of people living in the countryside who aren't, I mean, what about farmers? They live in the forest, and I suppose this is for remote jungle thicket resting places. Well, hunters. Anyway. But,
Campers,
exactly. Yeah, so there are campers. Okay.
So did you notice the shift from... the question was who's accomplished in this,
mm-hmm.
and then the answer has to do with those who have accomplished it or are practicing in this way. They're living in the jungle thickets, as though those who are striving are also worthy of respect.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fine, but it's just not there
in the first part of it.
Yeah, yeah. It's introduced here just in this part regarding the jungle.
Yeah, yeah.
Put in the context of the question of why the woman would ask a household, and it makes sense.
Uh-huh.
That's if the householders decide to change their support, and the one says, well, what sort of cruiser do you think should be on?
Uh-huh. Okay.
Right.
So the householders are deciding whether to support the Buddhist monks or...
Right, and then the rest of the war, hey, what's going on here?
Yeah. Yeah, why are you giving all your money to them? Yeah.
Well, they're not actually taking money, but yes.
Well, whatever, yeah. Money or respect or whatever, yeah.
Dumping resources.
Yep. Okay. So, fairly straightforward sutta for the Nagara Vindeya Sutta. And so the basic idea is advice to the householders on how to tell good recluses from non-good recluses.
It's not just a simplistic answer. I mean, nowadays, wouldn't you find a corrupt monk just as easily in a beautiful forest as in the city?
Absolutely, yeah. And in the forest monasteries, often more so, yeah. So I mean, the forest monasteries are usually much richer than the village monasteries.
So what is that about? I mean, how does that fit? Is there something that's changed in the meantime?
Well, I would think so, yeah, in some degrees. I mean, this is obviously talking about, like, literally living in the forest, yeah? Rather, it's not talking about, you know, living in wealthy and luxurious forest monasteries.
Yeah.
Yeah? So, I don't know if it's, this is the word here. When it says the Venerable Ones resort to remote jungle thicket resting places, it doesn't mean that they stay in resorts in the forest. and it's true that to a degree, where in some cases it's just people being unscrupulous that they deliberately kind of adopt the forms of a forest lifestyle in order to make money and those kinds of things. So in some cases it's just bad monks who do that. In other cases it's not because people are necessarily bad monks or whatever, but it's just a gradual process within the culture that those conditions gradually become more and more accepted or the norm, and you know it's part of the culture. You know, in a sense, it's a curious kind of thing. Like my experience in the Thai forest tradition. You know, on the one hand, there's a very kind of strong sense of identification. We are from the same tradition as Ajahn Mun, right? And it very much felt that we're here, we're in the Ajahn Mun tradition and so on and so forth. But at the same time, there's also a very clear and very humble recognition by most of the monks that we can't practice anything like what Ajahn Mun did, you know? And they know that. They're not trying to pretend anything different. But they also, there's also like a felt sense of community, yeah? So, and of course it's not to say that the other is not true as well. I mean, I still think it's true that generally speaking, in my experience in Thailand, you're more likely to find the sincere practicing bhikkhus in the forest monasteries, and there are still, of course, many forest monasteries which are very simple, very remote and very conducive to practice, and a lot of good practice going on with them. That's certainly the case. It's simply I'm not trying to say anything different. I'm just saying that it's not universally the case, and obviously there are good monastics in the cities and the villages as well, and also some in the forest monasteries that are not necessarily ideal.
Yes, it also then about no forms kind of what might be alive and of a kind that could look at the light and the sounds, and have they never heard the beautiful air bird? That's an awesome sound that you could hear.
I think maybe that's the problem. Yeah, if they'd done it in the Southern Highlands, they'd probably have to change that bit, because
how can you not
delight
in silver watchful? Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous. Just like you could take those cut flowers and have them on a table by in a beautiful resort.
It's more beautiful. Forest is much more beautiful than cities are.
Yeah, could you imagine watching the leeches?
Yes.
So I think the sign of beauty or the sign of enjoyable is the sign of the tired person. Some person may see the forest beautiful, but some person, they don't specificity and building are more beautiful, more enjoyable. So we can't say it's universal. Feeling is not universal. It's never universal. It's individual. And another thing, I can see that now that I see the Buddhist tradition get more support than the Chinese tradition, both in Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, and in Australia. I know in Australia many cities, monasteries, they don't have a lot of support like a Buddhist monastery. If you go to Bodhivana or in Bodhivana in Victoria, you know Venerable Kanana? They have a lot of support. Every time the monk in the Buddhist tradition is many things, but in Chibi monk is only 2-3 things. So, in the strength of faith, then you think that the only thing that monk can enjoy not from the self, but more from the faith. The Buddhist monk and monk have more things to enjoy than
the better food in the forest monasteries. Sure, yeah. And many of the certainly in Australia, many of the city monasteries and so on are very, very simple. You know, the way that monastics live in the cities, yeah. And annoying. I mean, it's not just, you've got the noise and the cars, it's not that all of the sights and sounds in the cities are pleasant and delightful and all of those kinds of things, yeah.
Yes, you have to have a lot of
Okay, so let's have a look at the comparative study. So the sutta. The beginning with the introduction, when the Brahmin household is coming to visit the Buddha, is expressed more simply in the Chinese Sanyukta Agama version. So it just says that they heard about the Buddha and they went to see him. The Sanskrit fragments, on the other hand, agree with the Pali in giving the more extensive introduction. Another correspondence between the Sanskrit fragments and the Pali version can be found in relation to their description of the behavior of the Brahmin householders when arriving in the Buddha's presence. Again, the Sanyukta Agama version simply notes that they bowed at his feet and sat down, while the Pali version describes a set of different behaviour patterns, with some visitors paying homage, others exchanging greetings, and others sitting down silently. And the Sanskrit fragments have reserved part of a description of these behaviour variations shown by the Buddha's visitors. So the Sanskrit fragments seem to agree with the Pali rather than the Chinese translation. Which again, it's somewhat noteworthy. I mean, it's not a huge deal, but normally you would expect the Sanskrit fragments to agree with the Chinese translation because they tend to be from the Sarvastivadin school. Anala goes on, this is noteworthy insofar as these Sanskrit fragments belong to a set of fragments that have preserved a whole series of discourses whose sequence corresponds closely to this section of the Samyukta Agama. Variations in the order in which discourses are placed within a Nikaya or Agama are usually characteristic of a different reciter tradition. Thus, judging from this similarity in the sequence of a whole series of discourses, the Sanskrit parallel to the Nagaravindeya Sutta should belong to a reciter tradition closely related to the reciter tradition whose Samyukta Agama version was eventually translated into Chinese. So the point that Anali is making there is that it's unusual that the Sanskrit and the Pali should be agree against the Chinese, because on other grounds it seems that the Chinese and the Sanskrit come from the same tradition, but specifically because of the sequence of suttas being identical. It's not really such a massive textual problem, since it's very normal in these kinds of things that one version or other, given that these are all stock passages, might simply lead some of the stock passages for the sake of brevity, and you find those kinds of variations even within the Pali tradition, for example, that different manuscript traditions will either spell out a particular passage in detail or else abbreviate it, so these kinds of variations you find all the time in the different Pali manuscript traditions, so that variation in itself isn't necessarily that significant. But it's only significant in the sense of tracing the affiliations of different textual traditions. According to the Nagaravindeya Sutta and its Samyukta Agama parallel, the Buddha had told his visitors how they should reply on being asked what kinds of recluse or Brahmins are not worthy of variation. A minor difference between the two versions is that according to the Majjhima Nikaya version, those who might put such an inquiry to the householders of Nagaravinda are heterodox wanderers. While the Samyukta Agama discourse simply attributes such a hypothetical inquiry to other people. Okay, so it was that point that I mentioned earlier. Analio then goes on to give a footnote. The Pali version's reference to wanderers of other sects is to some extent unexpected, as there seems to be no need to bring in the followers of other sects in that situation. All the more in view of the behaviour variations exhibited by the visitors according to the Pali account, which depicts an audience of which a considerable part did apparently not consider themselves disciples of the Buddha. In other discourses, instructions on how to properly answer wanderers were almost always given to Buddhist monks in order to prepare them to stand their ground in a debate situation. In the Digha Nikaya number 8, for example, such instructions are given to a heterodox wanderer shortly before he declares his wish to go forth as a Buddhist monk. Several discourses report that such encounters had already happened and the monks went back to the Buddha in order to learn how to answer such questions in the future. Okay, so you quite find that kind of situation quite often where somebody will be in some discussion and somebody will ask a question and they don't quite know how to answer, so they'll go to the Buddha and he'll explain, well, this is how you should answer. And so you see this kind of training or preparation was a kind of a standard part of the education, and seems to be unusual in this case. And Analia goes on, in contrast to such occurrences, it's not clear why the Buddha should feel the need to teach the householders of Nagaravinda, who had apparently not yet even become his lay disciples, how to reply to questions posed by what followers of other sects. From this perspective, the reference to people in general in the Chinese version fits the context better, since to discuss who should be venerated and who should not be venerated could well have been a topic of conversation among laity in general. Okay, so the discussion continues. The Pali and the Chinese counterpart agree that recluses and Brahmins who are still under the sway of lust in regard to experiences by way of the six senses should not be honoured. The two versions explain that such recluses and Brahmins are not worthy of respect and honour since they are not superior to householders. Both versions apply their treatment to the opposite case of recluses and Brahmins that are aloof in regard to experiences through the six senses and thus worthy of honour and worship. Okay, the two versions reckon a secluded way of life to be a good reason for assuming that a recluse and Brahman is either free from lust or else is engaging in the practice that leads to such freedom, since objects of the senses that have the potential to arouse lust are not found in secluded dwelling places. The Chinese version explains that the sense objects absent from secluded dwelling places are in particular those related to association with women. A way of understanding the implication of the present passage also reflected in the Pali commentary. Okay, so once again, the feature which we've noted many times, that what appear to be later additions to the text shared between the versions in the other traditions and the Pali commentary. The exact translation of the Chinese text here talks about staying in empty places at the root of a tree in the forest, sitting on a low seat of grass. They practice seclusion, keeping away from association with women. They delight in being alone with their thought collected in meditation. And the Pali commentary says, glosses the phrase on living in seclusion and saying that although in seclusion there are pleasurable objects of the senses, what the discourse's description intends is the absence of sense objects related to women. Iti rupadini pana sandhayetang katitang. So that's that. However, the exact phrasing of the Pali is also somewhat interesting here, and would have been nice for Analia to have mentioned this. But let's just have a look exactly what it says, because that gives us somewhat more. There's a slightly more nuanced picture that comes if you look at the exact phrasing used in the commentary. So this is the word that it used in the commentary. So the commentary says, this is spoken in connection with iti rupadini. Okay? Iti rupadini. Iti is woman. Rupa, sights. Adi. Yeah, I'm not quite sure where the ini comes from. Where's the ini come? Adi, ini. Must be ini. I'm not quite sure what the ini is there at the end there. But anyway, it's uti rup adi, which means women, sight, etc.
That would be arti, not adi. At your age, after the li. And
your
short eye
and
long eye.
It's the rupa.
Yeah,
arti,
beginning with your iti rupa, it means your woman form.
Yeah, but that's what that means.
No, beginning with your woman form.
But that's what, no, without the H. No. That's what that means. Mm-hmm. Adi is without H.
Corruption?
No. This is specifically a quote, and I'll show you where it's a quote from. It is a quote from the ones of the Anguttara Nikaya. And in fact, if you look here, Rupadi Vagga, the very first chapter of the Anguttara Nikaya, the Rupadi Vagga, yeah? And the very first section in that, as we have a look, 1.1. So the very beginning of the Anguttara Nikaya, something that the monks would have been very familiar with. It would be automatic that you know this, yeah? Okay? The first one, Nahang bhikkhave anyang eka rupampi samanupassami yang evang purisasa cittang pariyadayati yathayidang bhikkhave iti rupang bhikkhave purisasa cittang pariyadayati tatiti. I do not, because see any other form, any other single form, which would overwhelm a man's mind and remain to the extent of a, or to the same extent as a, the form or the sight of a woman. It is the sight of a woman that overwhelms and obsesses the mind of a man. That's the first sutta. That's the collection. Notice it's the Rup Adi Vagga. Yeah? The second then goes on with all the rest of them and then talks about the sound of a woman and smell, taste, touch and so on and so forth. But then it goes on to the same thing. What's going on here? Same thing for the opposite. I do not see a single form that obsesses the mind of a woman so much as the sight of a man. Yeah, it is the sight of a man which overwhelms a woman's mind and remains. Yeah, and so it then goes on for the rest of it. So, taken as a whole, then that chapter refers to obviously to the sexual desire and attraction between the sexes. And taken as a whole, it's not sexist. Obviously, it's talking about that usually men are attracted to women, women are attracted to men. And that phrase here clearly is meaning that it should be referred to as a whole. Iti rupadini. It's referring to that chapter, the rupadi vagga. Yeah? Yeah? It's an actual direct, it's not just a vague phrase, it's a direct textual reference to that. And it was meant to refer to all of those, but unfortunately because of the idiom, and it's the idiom in Pali that you start with the first one, and then you say etc., so because only the first one was dealing with women, then it sounds like that, so it sounds like it's sexist, whereas in this case it probably shouldn't be read in that way. Okay. Okay, so we're on to the yes. Okay, so according to the Nagaravindeya Sutta and its Samyukta Agama parallel, the householders expressed their appreciation for the Buddha's exposition by comparing his teachings to revealing something that was hidden, showing the path to someone who was lost, and holding up a lamp in the dark. Before delivering this set of similes found regularly in the discourses. On such occasions, according to the Samyukta Agama account, the householders remarked the Buddha had given a teaching without praising himself or disparaging others. A very useful remark and something to bear in mind when giving teachings. Exactly the same thing happened to me when I was in Canberra recently, and we gave the Commonwealth Day presentation. And so this was a major presentation. The Governor General was there, and so on and so forth. And all of the we all had to give some presentation from our own religious perspective. And everybody said a few words. We only had a few, a couple of minutes to speak, and we all said a few words. And then afterwards, one of the people who was there, I think it was an Anglican bishop actually, or somebody who was there, came up to me and said that, noticed that I was the only one who hadn't praised hadn't been trying to sort of sell his own religion and saying that how his religion was the best. I talked about was the contribution, because it was the Commonwealth Day, and so I talked about the contribution that the British scholars had made towards Buddhism. Thomas Rhys Davies and others. So expressing that appreciation rather than talking about what Buddhism can do for the Commonwealth. Talking about what Commonwealth can do for Buddhism. So, that's a very useful thing to bear in mind, because, in speaking and so on, then of course it's natural to be, speak in praise of your own religion or your own path. And, it's very, you see the Buddha's very good example in that's what he's not doing. He's not saying, go and support the Buddhist monks and don't support the others. He's saying, well, look, see how they're practicing. If they're practicing well and they're restrained, then support those ones. So it was a very, very useful remark by the householders there. Another little difference is that in the Chinese version, the householders also remarked that the Buddha had extensively taught them dependent origination. Somewhat curious. Perhaps related to his clarification of the reasons that make someone worthy of respect. Somewhat curious little detail, but perhaps it might be a translation mistake. Perhaps they were saying that the Buddha taught with reason and not without reason. Yeah? Rather than saying he taught dependent origination. And there seems to be an editorial mistake in the Chinese, in this point at the end, it mentions that the ones who are praising the Buddha are not just the Brahmin householders, but also the wanderers. So it seems like the wanderers got somehow included by mistake there, because they weren't mentioned anywhere else in the discourse. The Pali version concludes by reporting the householders took refuge as lay followers. So the standard passage on going for refuge. The Chinese version does not record that the householders took refuge, but the Sanskrit fragments appear to agree with the Pali account, as the concluding section of the Sanskrit version has preserved part of the formulaic expression used to take refuge. And the words is simply rmanja bhikkhu sangha. So the normal phrase is dharmanja bhikkhu sanghancha, and of those it just preserves rmanja bhikkhu sangha. So this is, you know, showing you how little is preserved of these things. When it talks about fragments, that's actually all that's there from that end part. It's just 1.5 words, right? And 1.5 words which are fairly innocuous words. I mean, very common words in Buddhism, right? It just says Dhamma and Bhikkhu Sangha. I mean, you could hardly imagine two more common kind of words to find in a Buddhist text. But by knowing the context that they appear in, yeah, what other words that they appear together with in phrases, then this is how the scholars are able to identify them as belonging to one particular text or another. And even though we only have that tiny little fragment, we're still able to say, well, it most likely has the formula for going for refuge in that version. So, I mean, you can appreciate how difficult it is for the scholars to put these things, and how you know, what a good knowledge of the Pali text you have to be able to recognize all these things, right? You know, just these little scraps of phrases, and you've got to say, well, where in the Pali discourses is there a parallel to this? You know, not an easy task to do at all. Yeah, I mean, this is the reason why the studies and the publishing of these things is extremely slow. Pali and Chinese and other translations, yeah. I mean, and that, because there's multiple differences. I mean, these days, of course, if you can do, you know, text searching, that makes it much easier. But still, it's not 100% because, well, you know, there's different kinds of variations and so on. You can do text searches within the Pali canon fairly easily. But, of course, then in Chinese, you've got all kinds of problems with translation and so on and so forth as well. That the same words will be translated in different ways by different translators. So, not an easy task. But of course, in one sense, it's building up. You know, there's a body of knowledge which has been built up over the last century and a half of this kind of work that people can build onto. But yeah, still. Okay, so this is the Nagara Vinda Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 150. Okay, so we have two suttas left, Pindapata Parisuddhi and the Indriya Bhavana Sutta. So we'll do those two next week.
We're in the home stretch, aren't we?
We are, yeah. Okay, very good.